Welcome back to In the Moment. We love finding people raised in South Dakota who have gone on to live lives in the world beyond. This week we discovered Heather Heintz. She was raised in the Black Hills, but now lives and works in Hawaii. She's headed home this weekend for a reunion, but she's also been asked to teach a yoga workshop at Soul Yoga Collective in Rapid City. I caught up with Heather outside of Hilo, Hawaii, to talk about life, death, and her quest to make yoga more inclusive.
One of the ways I like to teach is to kind of see who shows up to practice and what the need is. I've taught yoga for many, many years here in Hawaii, and I don't teach very often anymore. I usually wait until I'm asked, and a friend of mine who is a student at Soul Yoga knew that I was going to come back to Rapid City for a few days for a reunion and said, would you like to teach at Soul? And I said, that feels really good. That feels really right. So I connected with Karen, the owner, and she said, you know, we're a really open yoga collective, and, you know, we'd like to just offer the community an arrangement of styles and practices and lineages. And so I said, let me teach a open class on Friday night and see what's there. And if there's a specific need of your community that I can fill, then we'll offer a workshop that fills that need on Sunday. Mm-hmm. But I always teach yoga in a way that is really grounded in clear asana direction, without very much fluff.
Okay.
And to really give people a chance to be in their bodies and to practice coming up against positions and situations that make them a little bit uncomfortable and keeps them there a little bit. Gives them a time to breathe and adjust and adapt their reaction.
What is it like for you to come home to the Black Hills after being gone for 16 years? At least.
I don't know. I was there 10 years ago to connect with friends, and then I came back to Spearfish to help my grandmother leave her body. She was at the end of her life, and I came back for a few weeks about 5 years ago, and it feels neat. It's a return. I mean, South Dakota's in my bones. It's in my cellular makeup, and there's a part of me that longs for that place. You know, it's such a sacred place, and I think something deeper inside of me longs to come home for a longer period of time to, you know, reconcile my relationship with the place that I feel now, being gone for 16 years, is, you know, sacred to our Indigenous people and our, you know, Lakota people, that I was never given that education. And so there's a part of me that feels like I would like to come home and drop into, you know, the Black Hills as a place that I wasn't taught as I was raised. So there's that part of me. But I'm excited to come home. My dad will be there. He lives there. My sister's coming back from the Twin Cities to see me. I still have a lot of friends from high school that live there, have returned there, and I'm really looking forward to being in Rapid City for a week.
Has your time living in Hawaii changed how you view the Black Hills then, when you talk of Indigenous people?
I think my time, yeah, my time living in Hawaii in a place that has, you know, also in a way been colonized just a lot later. And seeing the original voice of this place still very clear, and the language used, and, you know, just a deep reverence for the original people here has given me time to think about where I was raised and in my upbringing and the Indigenous people of my place, you know. And so, yeah, it's given me a chance to see the Black Hills differently, you know. And I ask people who live there, especially the last couple of months as I've been making this return home, you know, what's it like now? Is there still a tension there? And it seems like, you know, they've changed the name of Harney Peak, and there's been some movement back to really give recognition and reverence to our original people of the Black Hills. Mm-hmm. And that makes me feel really good. And, you know, but I'm distant from that place still. You know, Hawaii's far, and I don't stay that connected to the Black Hills.
Right. Tell me about your path to yoga then. Is it something that started when you lived in South Dakota, or did you come to yoga much later?
Well, I came to yoga through Zazen. So during my time, I went to undergraduate school at Montana State University at Bozeman, and I had a great opportunity to study abroad throughout that whole program. And I had first left with my first teacher, Dr. Montaigne, and we had gone to the Mongolian countryside for the summer, and he knew that I had a copy of Suzuki Roshi's Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind in my backpack, and I had an affinity for sit practice. And so he had, on our way home from Mongolia, we were in the airport in Tokyo, and he gave me a railroad pass, a Japan rail pass, and said, I want you to go connect with my friends and teachers here in Japan for 2 months. And that was a gift he gave to me. So I just dropped everything and did it. And I went and lived in a Zen monastery. I was 19. And I had some pretty profound experiences at a young age, and just some big awakening about the interconnectedness of all things. And I wanted to live a life of service and practice. And after my time there was done, I came back and also didn't really have the tools to reintegrate into a undergraduate life in Bozeman, Montana. And lucky there was an Ashtanga yoga class being offered. And I was able to step into that class. And although very different, that practice of asana is similar to sitting Zazen. It's a practice of breath and showing up and just being in the practice. And so that was kind of my lifeline at that time, to stay practiced with Ashtanga yoga. And then I was never very good at asana. It wasn't something that came natural for me. It was always really hard. But I stayed committed to it. And I started practicing with a woman named Randa Shahab in Koligar. And the three of us would wake up really early and before the sun and meet in the attic and practice primary series. And then I took that practice with me as I continued studying abroad and, you know, moved to Iceland and offered yoga classes there, only for my practice, but it gave me a really safe vehicle to refine what it was going to be to offer the practice to other people. I had my copy of the primary series and my copy of Light on Yoga by BKS Iyengar. You know, both of them were students of Krishnamacharya, and I committed to that lineage, that Krishnamacharya lineage, you know, as a teenager, and I stuck with it. And, you know, and then later, of course, you know, moving to Hawaii after Iceland, that I ended up dropping out of school to stay here and started an Ashtanga yoga program at the University of Hawaii in Hilo. And that was really cool. It was really natural. It was just people coming together to practice. Talked a lot about the eight limbs of yoga and the primary series and did it. And it was at a time that was, I did that for a few years. And then come 2004, I was able to buy a house in Hawaii and turn the upstairs into a yoga studio and live downstairs. And I called it Balancing Monkey Yoga Center. And I just leapt. I named it after Hanuman, the monkey god who embodies trust and devotion. And I did it. I just leapt. And I feel like when you do that, you're in right relationship with God and you're just well cared for. And I felt, you know, it was risky and perfect. And we built a yoga community here in Hilo.
So tell me about All Bodies Rise.
Sure. So All Bodies Rise Yoga was something that a good friend of mine, Jennifer Zimmerman, she's in Tucson, Arizona. A lot of later on in my teaching, I guess you could call it career, although it always just feels like who I am, a practice, was through Yoga Oasis in Tucson, Arizona. Darren Rhodes is one of my favorite teachers, and Christina Stahl. And Jennifer Zimmerman teaches at Yoga Oasis and is in connection with these folks for a long time. And I was finishing up my master's in social work and was doing a social justice program. And Jen has always been an advocate for social justice in Tucson. And so we teamed up to bring social justice to yoga. And the way in which we found an entry point to that, because there's many, was body image. And I feel like, you know, we live in a culture that emphasizes a mostly, you know, fabricated thin ideal, and that this advertising adversely affects women especially, you know, by encouraging them to conform to a beauty standard. And because the beauty standard is unattainable, right, body dissatisfaction and poor body image have become kind of a normative discontent. Hmm. And I feel like there are also parts of westernized yoga culture that have adopted the same harmful beauty standards as popular media. And so, you know, in this way, yoga is contributing to kind of mass body dysmorphia, and we do it accidentally. We're so conditioned to, we've so bought into that, you know, we're not good enough, and we accidentally do it. You know, most yoga classes you walk into are thin, white, able-bodied women with enough money to afford yoga classes. And so we just wanted to make a stand and make yoga spaces more inclusive. Hmm. And so we offer a lot of workshops, and we offer additional pieces to folks' teacher training that just start having the conversation about how, you know, ways in which Western culture has really brought new life and breath into yoga and kept it alive in a lot of ways, and also has overlaid, you know, some of these more mainstream negative messages. And sure, just nice to deconstruct that a little bit. We all feel it. Those of us who have practiced long enough feel there's something a little off. Like, do I have the right outfit on to practice yoga, or am I right? Do I look good enough in this outfit? I mean, like, it's real. We've done it, and we're so conditioned to think that's okay, and it's not. And it's at the heart of the practice. And I also think, you know, in the spirit of ABRI, or All Bodies Rise, another thing we have done, in a way kind of appropriated it, is made yoga so it's about being really comfortable and kind of overlaying this magical thinking and flowery language. And that's not what the practice is, at least not through my lens. And everybody has their own lens, and all lenses are welcome. But I feel like there's more to the practice than cultivating or having an intention and all this language that just has also become normal in a yoga class that's kind of void of meaning and truth. So, so that's what All Bodies Rise Yoga is.
Yeah. How do you get at that truth then, you know, through practice? Are there certain fundamentals that you adhere to?
Yeah. So I feel like being well practiced is about our ability to have an appropriate response that is grounded in the yamas and the niyamas. So those are kind of the precepts of Ashtanga yoga.
Elaborate a little bit, because I'm not sure what you mean there. Be specific.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. So, you know, I feel like an appropriate response for, you know, the liberation of whatever is arising at the moment. And when I say liberation, I mean liberation from a habit energy, you know, from a more wakeful state. And that appropriate response is grounded in the yamas and the niyamas. So the yamas are the way we are in the world, and the niyamas are the way we are with ourselves. Mm. And so in Sanskrit, the yamas are ahimsa, satya, asteya, brahmacharya, aparigraha. That's loving-kindness, truthfulness, non-hoarding, non-reaching, clear boundaries. And then the niyamas, or the way we are in the world, are saucha, santosha, tapas, svadhyaya, and ishvara pranidhana. The translation of those, saucha is just living a clean life. Mm. Santosha is just a steady ease. Tapas is a burning desire to grow. Svadhyaya is self-study, and then Ishvara Pranidhana is your relationship with God. Yeah, so, you know, and then I think from a teaching perspective, just giving folks, you know, empowering people to the best of my ability to have an appropriate response that is right for them. you know. The niyamas and the yamas and Ashtanga yoga is a structure. It's a reliable structure. And I think structures are important to use and also not to cling too tightly to. You know, each person is really on their path. Mm-hmm. But my experience is that really yoga practice gives us the tools to be upright for whatever comes along our way, you know, and to just stand in it and to not avoid it, but to be it, to feel it, to walk through it. Mm. But that's a tall order.
Right. Exactly.
Especially, you know, we love to be comfortable. So that's a tall order. So all is welcome. And I feel like I sound kind of serious. And actually, a lot of my teaching is teasing the practice a little bit and bringing laughter and joy into it, too.
Let's talk a little bit, not to be serious and stay on that serious note, but I'm curious,
sure.
curious a little bit about your work in hospice and as an ordained Buddhist chaplain. Tell me, what are the Buddhist principles that you bring into hospice work?
So same, it's like the same principles I bring into my yoga teaching.
There you go.
they really overlap. Being a chaplain, when I think about what that means for me personally, it's just coming alongside of, you know, being with people as a companion through the processes of life and death. And, you know, my actual role as a chaplain is to see if people who are at this final phase and their family and their caregivers are experiencing any existential suffering. You know, that's suffering that can't be medicated or, you know, can't really necessarily even be talked about. But to provide presence with that and just be with people as they express what's going on for them. And some of that work involves deep reconciliation with other and self. And a lot of that work just involves, for me, just, you know, sitting with people in a Carl Rogers kind of way, just with unconditional positive regard for them. Mm. When I meet people at the end of life, I don't have a big story of them. I just get to see them as a complete human being as they are. And that's really a powerful position to have with people. Not in a power differential way, but just an empowering position to have is like for people just to really be seen as complete human beings in a really vulnerable time. Is part of my role. Hmm. And, you know, and it's also empower. I don't want to use that word too much. It's affirming with family members who are with their loved ones who are dying that they can do it. Hmm. It is scary. It is unknown territory for most of us. And when we choose to step onto it, it's one of the most beautiful experiences we can have. So a lot of that work is just giving people permission to be afraid and doing it anyway.
Wow. For the people who are going to, there's people who are going to come to your workshop, be able to see you in person. For those who can't, but are maybe inspired by some of your thoughts today, do you have recommendations what to look for in their own town for a yoga instructor, what to read? What to sort of, you know, to take a step onto the path of yoga?
Oh, that's such a cool question. Thanks for asking that one. Yes. I think reading-wise, anything by BKS Iyengar. Mm. He has recently left his body, so he's no longer with us on the planet, but his writing is inspiring and clear and in lineage, so that would be what I would encourage people to start with. Even Light on Yoga, which was written in the 70s, is still with me everywhere I go. Hmm. I think, you know, I trained with Roshi Joan Halifax for my chaplaincy work, and so if some of the death and dying and being with people, if that's what you want to learn more about, anything by Roshi Joan is quality and finding a teacher in your hometown, yes. Explore. Go check them out. Step on your mat. Don't care what you're wearing. Show up in jeans. Show up in sweats. You're perfect the way you are. You don't need to do anything in order to get into a yoga class. Go. Be in your body. Practice. pay attention.
Heather Heintz is a yoga teacher, an ordained Buddhist chaplain, and a South Dakota native. She currently lives in Hilo, Hawaii. She teaches a yoga workshop this Sunday at 11 at Soul Yoga Collective in Rapid City. That's our program for today. We hope that it served you. SDPB Radio undergoes a change in equipment this week. In the Moment returns to its two-hour format on Monday. And coming up on Monday's program, we meet a South Dakota farmer who's landed on a top 10 list for successful farmers. We meet more South Dakota Vietnam veterans, plus a conversation with musician Sarah Voss. Coming up next, from Intelligence Squared US, as video games gain prominence, some game creators are turning to global issues, such as poverty alleviation, international diplomacy, and combating climate change for inspiration. Playing these socially minded games, they argue, allows users to build tangible skills in combating crises and solving critical problems. But others see the multi-billion dollar gaming industry, dominated by portrayals of crime and war, as a threat that desensitizes its users to violence and encourages antisocial behavior. Stay tuned for the debate. From all of us at South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.